That heavy armor?
Yes. The trainers in those exoskeletons can run at 32 kilometers per hour, lift 2 tons, and have a 30-millimeter minigun mounted on self-targeting armatures. Stun rounds, of course. They're also equipped with the latest motion sensors and IR scopes. And needless to say, their armor is impervious to standard light weapons. It would take 2 or 3 platoons of conventional Marines to take that bunker.
Mendez spoke again in the microphone, and his voice echoed off the cavern walls.
Start the drill!
60 seconds ticked by. Nothing happened. 120 seconds. Where are the Spartans? Dr. Halsey asked.
They're here, Mendez replied.
Dr. Halsey caught a glimpse of motion in the dark. A shadow against shadows. A familiar silhouette.
Kelly?
She whispered. The trainers turned and fired at the shadow, but it moved with almost supernatural quickness. Even the self-targeting systems couldn't track it. From above, a man free-rappelled down from the girders and gantries overhead. The newcomer landed behind one of the perimeter guards, quiet as a cat. He punched the guard's armor twice, denting the heavy plates, then dropped low and swept the target's legs out from under him. The guard sprawled on the ground. The Spartan attached his rappelling line to the trainer. A moment later, the writhing guard shot upward into the darkness. 2 other guards turned to attack. The Spartan dodged, rolled, and melted into the shadows. Dr. Halsey realized the trainer's exoskeleton wasn't being pulled up. It was being used as a counterweight. 2 more Spartans, dangling from the other end of that rope, dropped unnoticed into the center of the bunker. Dr. Halsey immediately recognized one of them, although he was dressed entirely in black, save his open eye slits. Number 117, John. John landed, braced, and kicked one guard. The man landed in a heap, 8 meters away. The other Spartan jumped off the bunker. He flipped end over end, evading the stun rounds that filled the air. He threw himself at the farthest guard, and they skidded together into the shadows. The guard's gun strobed once. Then it was dark again. On top of the bunker, John was a blur of slashing motions. A second guard's exosuit erupted in a fountain of hydraulic fluid and then collapsed under the armor's weight. The last guard on the bunker turned to fire at John. Halsey gripped the edge of her chair.
He's at point-blank range! Even stun rounds can kill at that distance!
As the guard's gun fired, John sidestepped. The stun rounds slashed through the air, a clean miss. John grabbed the weapon's armature, twisted, and with a screech of stressed metal, wrenched it free of the exoskeleton. He fired directly into the man's chest and sent him tumbling off the bunker. The remaining quartet of perimeter guards turned and sprayed the area with suppression fire. A heartbeat later, the lights went out. Mendez cursed and keyed the mic.
Backups! Hit the backup lights now!
A 12 amber floods flickered to life. Not a Spartan was in sight. But the 9 trainers were either unconscious or lay immobile in inert battle armor. The red flag was gone.
Show me that again,
Dr. Halsey said unbelievingly.
You recorded all that, didn't you?
Of course.
Mendez tapped a button, but the monitors played back static.
Damn it, they got to the cameras too, he muttered, impressed. Every time we find a new place to hide them, they disable the recording devices.
Dr. Halsey leaned against the glass wall, staring at the carnage below.
Very well, Chief Mendez. What else do I need to know?
Your Spartans can run at bursts of up to 55 kilometers per hour, he explained. Kelly can run a little faster, I think. They will only get quicker as they adjust to the alterations we've made to their bodies. They can lift 3 times their body weight, which I might add is almost double the norm due to their increased muscle density, and they can virtually see in the dark.
Dr. Halsey pondered this new data.
They should not be performing so well. There must be unexplained synergistic effects brought on by the combined modifications. What are their reaction times?
Almost impossible to chart. We estimated at 20 milliseconds, Mendez replied.
He shook his head, then added,
I believe it's significantly faster in combat situations when their adrenaline is pumping.
Any physiological or mental instabilities?
None. They work like no team I've ever seen before. Damn near telepathic, if you ask me. They were dropped in these caves yesterday, and I don't know where they got black suits or the rope for that maneuver, but I can guarantee they haven't left this room. They improvise and improve and adapt. And, he added, they like it. The tougher the challenge, the harder the fight, the better their morale becomes.
Dr. Halsey watched as the first trainer stirred and struggled to get out of his inert armor.
They might as well have been killed, she murmured. But can the Spartans kill, Chief? Kill on purpose? Are they ready for real combat?
Mendez looked away and paused before he spoke.
Yes, if we ordered them to, they would kill quite efficiently.
His body stiffened.
May I ask what real combat you mean, ma'am?
She clasped her hands and wrung them nervously.
Something has happened, Chief. Something ONI and the Admiralty never expected. The Brass wants to deploy the Spartans. They want to test them in a real combat mission.
They're as ready for that as I can make them, Mendez said.
He'd narrowed his dark eyes.
But this is far ahead of your schedule. What happened? I've heard rumors there was some heavy action near Harvest Colony.
Your rumors are out of date, Chief,
she said, and a chill crept into her voice.
There's no more fighting at Harvest. There is no more Harvest.
Dr. Halsey punched the descent button, and the observation room slowly lowered to the floor.
Get them out of this hole, she said crisply. I want them ready to muster at 0400. We have a briefing at 0600 tomorrow aboard the London. We're taking them on a mission ONI has been saving for the right crew and the right time. This is it.
Yes, ma'am, Mendez replied.
Tomorrow, we see if all the pain they've been through has been worth it.
Chapter 9 0605 hours, September 12th, 2525, military calendar. UNSC destroyer Pioneer, en route to Eridanus system. John and the other Spartans stood at ease. The briefing room aboard the UNSC destroyer Pioneer made him uncomfortable. The holographic projectors at the fore end of the triangular room showed the field of stars visible off the bow of the ship. John wasn't used to seeing so much space. He kept expecting the room to decompress explosively. The stars flickered and faded, and the overhead lights warmed. Chief Petty Officer Mendez and Dr. Halsey entered the room. The Spartans snapped to attention.
At ease, Mendez said.
He clasped his hands behind his back and clenched his jaw muscles. The chief looked almost nervous. That made John nervous, too. Dr. Halsey walked to the podium. The overhead light reflected off her glasses.
Good morning, Spartans. I have good news for you. The word has come down. Command has decided to test your unique abilities. You have a new mission, an insurgent base in the Eridanus system.
A star map appeared on the wall and zoomed in to show a warm orange sun ringed with 12 planets.
In 2513, an armed insurrection in the system was suppressed by the UNSC force. Operation Trebuchet.
An intersystem tactical map appeared, and tiny icons representing destroyers and carriers winked on. They engaged a force of 100 smaller ships. Pinpoints of fire appeared against the dark.
The insurrection was put down, Dr. Halsey continued. However, elements of the rebel forces escaped and regrouped in the local asteroid belt.
The map tilted and moved into the circle of debris around the star.
Billions of rocks, Dr. Halsey said, where they hid from our forces, and continue to hide to this day. For some time, ONI believed that the rebels were disorganized and were lacking in leadership. That appears to have changed. We believe that one of these asteroids has been hollowed out, and that a formidable base has been constructed within. UNSC explorations into the belt have met either with no contact or with an ambush by superior forces.
She paused, pushed up her glasses, and added, "The Office of Naval Intelligence has also confirmed that FleetCom has discovered a security breach within their organization. A rebel sympathizer leaking information to these forces." John and the other Spartans shifted uneasily. A leak? It was possible. Deja had shown them many historical battles that had been won and lost because of traitors or informants, but it never occurred to him that it could happen in the UNSC. A flat picture flashed over the star map. A middle-aged man with thinning hair, a neatly trimmed beard, and watery gray eyes. "This is their leader," Dr. Halsey said. "Colonel Robert Watts. The original photo was taken after Operation Trebuchet and has been computer-aged. Your mission is to infiltrate the rebel base, capture Watts, and return him, alive and unharmed, to UNSC-controlled space. This will deprive the rebels of their new leadership, and it will provide ONI a chance to interrogate Watts and root out traitors within FleetCom." Dr. Halsey stepped aside.
"Chief Mendez?"
Mendez exhaled and unclasped his hands. He strode to the podium and cleared his throat.
"This operation will be different from your previous missions. You will be engaging the enemy using live rounds and lethal force. They will be returning the favor. If there is any doubt, any confusion, and make no mistake, in combat there will be confusion. Take no chances. Kill first, ask questions later. Support on this mission will be limited to the resources and firepower of this destroyer," Mendez continued. "This is to minimize the chance of a leak in the command structure."
Mendez walked to the star map. The face of Colonel Watts snapped off, and blueprints for a Parabola-class freighter appeared.
"Although we don't know the location of the rebel base, we believe they receive periodic shipments from Eridanus II. The independent freighter Layden is due to leave space dock in 6 hours for a routine recertification of her engines. She's being loaded with enough food and water to supply a small city. Additionally, her captain has been identified as a rebel officer, thought to have been killed during Operation Trebuchet. You will slip aboard this freighter and hopefully hitch a ride to the rebel base. Once there, infiltrate the installation, grab Watts, and get off of that rock any way you can."
Chief Mendez gazed at them all.
"Questions?"
"Sir," John said. "What are our extraction options?"
"You have two options. A panic button that will relay a distress signal to a pre-established listening ship. Also, the Pioneer will stay on station, briefly. Our window here is 13 hours.
He tapped the star map on the edge of the asteroid belt, and it glowed with a blue nav marker.
"I'll leave the extraction choice up to you. But let me point out that this asteroid belt has a circumference of more than 1 billion kilometers, making it impossible to canvass with ONI surveillance craft. If things get hot, you will be on your own. Any other questions?"
The Spartans sat, silent and immobile.
"No? Well, listen up, recruits," Mendez added. "This time I've told you all the twists that I know of. Be prepared for anything."
His gaze fixed on John.
"Squad leader, you are hereby promoted to the rank of Petty Officer 3rd Class.
"Sir!"
John snapped to attention.
"Assemble your team and equipment. Be ready to muster at 0300. We'll drop you off at the Eridanus 2 docks. You're on your own from there."
"Yes, sir,"
John said. Mendez saluted. He and Dr. Halsey then left the room. John turned to face his teammates. The other Spartans stood at attention. 33. Too many for this operation. He needed a small team. 5 or 6 maximum.
"Sam, Kelly, Linda, and Fred, meet me in the weapons locker in 10 minutes.
The other Spartans sighed, and their gaze dropped to the deck.
"The rest of you fall out. You'll have the more difficult part of this mission. You'll have to wait here."
The weapons locker of the Pioneer had been stocked with a bewildering array of combat equipment. On a table were guns, knives, communication gear, body armor explosives, medical packs, survival gear, portable computers, even a thruster pack for maneuvering in space. More important than the equipment, however, John assessed his team. Sam had recovered from the augmentation faster than any of the other Spartans. He paced impatiently around the crates of grenades. He was the strongest of them all. He stood taller than John by a head. He had grown out his sandy hair to 3 centimeters. Chief Mendez had warned him that he was going to look like a civilian soon. Kelly, in contrast, had taken the longest to recover. She stood in the corner with her arms crossed over her chest. John had thought she wasn't going to make it. She was still gaunt, and her hair had yet to grow back. Her face, however, still had its rough, angular beauty. She scared John a little, too. She was fast before. Now, no one could touch her if she didn't allow it. Fred sat cross-legged on the deck, twirling a razor-edged combat knife and glistening arcs. He always came in second in all the contests. John thought he could have come in first, but he just didn't like the attention. He was neither too short nor too tall. He wasn't overly muscled or slim. His black hair was shot with streaks of silver, a feature he hadn't had before the augmentation. If anyone in the group could blend into a crowd, it would be him. Linda was the quietest member of the group. She was pale, had close-cropped red hair and green eyes. She was a crack shot, an artist with a sniper rifle. Kelly circled the table once, and then selected a pair of grease-stained blue coveralls. Her name had been sloppily embroidered on the chest.
"These are new trainee uniforms?"
"Oh, and I provided them," John said. "They're supposed to match with the crew of the Laden wares." Kelly held up the coveralls and frowned.
"They don't give a girl much to work with. Try this on for size."
Linda held a black bodysuit up to Kelly's long, slender frame. They had used these black suits before. They were form-fitting, lightweight polymer body armor. They could deflect a small-caliber round and had refrigeration heating units that would mask infrared signatures. The integrated helmet had encryption and communications gear, a heads-up display, and thermal and motion detectors. Sealed tight, the unit had a 15-minute reserve of oxygen to let the wearer survive in a vacuum. The suits were uncomfortable, and they were tricky to repair in the field. And they always needed repairs.
"They're too tight," Kelly said. "It'll limit my range of motion."
"We wear them for this op," John told her. "There are too many places between here and there with nothing to breathe but vacuum. As for the rest of your equipment, take what you want, but stay light. Without recon data on this place, we're going to be moving fast, or we'll be dead." The team started selecting their weapons first.
"390 caliber?" Fred asked.
"Yes," John replied.
"Everyone take guns that use 390 caliber ammunition so we can share clips if we have to, except Linda."
Linda gravitated to a matte black long-barreled rifle, the SRS-99C-S2AM. The sniper rifle system had modular sections, scopes, stocks, barrels, even the firing mechanism could be swapped. She quickly stripped the rifle down and reconfigured it. She assembled a flash and sound suppression barrel, and then, to compensate for the lower muzzle velocity, she increased the ammunition caliber to .45. She ditched all the sights and scopes and settled for an integrated link to her helmet's heads-up display. She pocketed 5 extended ammunition clips. John also chose an MA-2B, a cut-down version of the standard MA-5B assault rifle. It was tough and reliable, with electronic targeting and an ammo supply indicator. It also had a recoil reduction system and could deliver an impressive 15 rounds per second. He picked up a knife, 20-centimeter blade, 1 serrated edge, non-reflective titanium carbide, and balanced for throwing. John grabbed the panic button, a tiny single-shot emergency beacon. It had 2 settings. The red setting alerted the pioneer that it had hit the fan and to come in guns blazing. The green setting merely marked the location of the base for later assault by the UNSC. He took a double handful of ammo clips, then paused. He set them down and pocketed 5. If they got into a firefight or he'd need that much firepower, their mission was over anyway. Everyone took similar equipment, with a few variations. Kelly selected a small computer pad with IR links. She also had their field medical kit. Fred packed a standard issue lockbreaker. Linda selected 3 nav marker transmitters, each the size of a tick. The trackers could be adhered to an object and would broadcast that object's location to the Spartans' heads-up displays. Sam hefted 2 medium-sized backpacks, damage packs. They were filled with C-12, enough high explosives to blow through 3 meters of battleship armor plate. "You have enough of that stuff?" Kelly asked him wryly.
"You think I should take more?" Sam replied and smiled. "Nothing like a little fireworks to celebrate the end of a mission."
"Everyone ready?" John asked. Sam's smile disappeared, and he slapped an extended clip into his MA-2B.
"Ready."
Kelly gave him a thumbs up. Fred and Linda nodded.
"Then let's go to work."
Chapter 10 1210 hours, September 14th, 2525, military calendar. Epsilon Edrani system. Eridanus II space dock. Civilian cargo ship. Laden. Registry number F0980 Whiskey. Spartan 117 in position. Next check in at 0400. John clicked off the microphone, encrypted the message, and fed it into his comm relay. He triggered a secure burst transmission to the Athens, the ONI prowler ship on station, a few AUs distant. He and his teammates climbed onto the support girders. In silence, the team rigged a web of support nets so they could rest in relative comfort. Below them lay 100,000 liters of black water, and surrounding them, 2 centimeters of stainless steel. Sam rigged the fill sensor so the reservoir's computer wouldn't let any more water flow into the storage tank. The lights in their helmets cast a pattern of crossing and crisscrossing reflection lines. A perfect hiding spot, all according to plan, John thought, and allowed himself a small grin of triumph. The tech specs that ONI had procured in the Leighton showed a number of hydroponic pods mounted aboard the ship's carousel system. The massive water tanks used gravity feed to irrigate the ship's space-grown crops. Perfect. They had easily slipped past the lone guard in the Leighton's main cargo bay and into the nearly deserted center section. The water tank would mask their thermal signatures and block any motion sensors. The only risky element entered the picture if the center section stopped spinning. Things could get very messy inside the tank very fast, but John doubted that would happen. Kelly set up a tiny microwave relay outside the top hatch. She propped her data pad on her stomach and linked to the ship's network.
"I'm in," she reported. "There's no AI or serious encryption. Accessing their system now."
She tapped the pad a few more times and activated the intrusion software, the best that ONI could provide. A moment later, the pad pulsed to indicate success.
"They've got a nav trajectory to the asteroid belt. ETA is 10 hours.
"Good work," John said. "Team, we'll sleep in shifts."
Sam, Fred, and Linda snapped off their flashlights. The tank reverberated as the Leighton's engines flared to life. The water tilted as they accelerated away from the orbital docking station. John remembered Eridanus II, vaguely recalled that it once was home. He wondered if his old school, his family, were still there. He squelched his curiosity. Speculation made for a fine mental exercise, but the mission came first. He had to stay alert, or failing that, grab some sleep so he would be alert when he needed to be. Chief Mendez must have told them 1,000 times.
"Rest can be as deadly a weapon as a pistol or grenade."
"I've got something,"
Kelly whispered, and handed him her data pad. It displayed the cargo manifest for the Leighton. John scrolled down the list. Water, flour, milk, frozen orange juice, welding rods, superconducting magnets for a fusion reactor. No mention of weapons.
"I give up," he said. "What am I looking for?"
"I'll give you a hint," Kelly replied. "The chief smokes them."
John flicked back through the list. There, Sweet William cigars. Next to them on the manifest was a crate of champagne, a Beta Centauri vintage. There were fast-chilled New York steaks and Swiss chocolates. These items were stored in a secure locker. They had the same routing codes.
Luxury items, Kelly murmured. I bet they're headed straight for a special delivery to Colonel Watts or his officers.
Good work, John replied. We'll tag this stuff and follow it.
Won't be that easy,
Fred said from the darkness. He flicked on his flashlight and peered back at John.
There are a million ways this can go wrong. We're going in without recon. I don't like it.
We only have one advantage on this mission, John said. The rebels have never been infiltrated. They'll feel relatively safe and won't be expecting us. But every extra second we stay, that's another chance for us to be spotted. We'll follow Kelly's hunch.
You questioning orders? Sam asked Fred. Scared?
There was a slight hint of challenge in his voice. Fred thought for a moment.
No, he whispered. But this is no training mission. Our targets won't be firing stun rounds. He sighed. I just don't want to fail.
We're not going to fail, John told him. We've accomplished every mission we've been on before. That wasn't entirely true. The augmentation mission had wiped out half of the Spartans. They weren't invincible. But John wasn't scared. A little nervous, maybe. But he was ready. Rotate sleep cycles, John said. Wake me up in 4 hours. He turned over and quickly nodded off to the sound of the sloshing water. He dreamed of grav ball and a coin spinning in the air. John caught it and yelled, "Eagle!" as he won again. He always won. Kelly nudged John's shoulder, and he was instantly awake, hand on his assault rifle.
"We're decelerating,"
she whispered, and pointed her light into the water below. The liquid tilted at a 20-degree inclination.
"Lights off," John ordered.
They were plunged into total darkness. He popped the hatch and snaked the fiber optic probe, attached to his helmet, through the crack. All clear. They climbed out, then rappelled down the back of the 10-meter-tall tank. They donned their grease-stained coveralls and removed their helmets. The black suits looked a little bulky beneath their work clothes, but the disguise would hold up to a cursory inspection. With their weapons and gear in duffel bags, they'd pass as crew. From a distance. They crept through a deserted corridor and into the cargo bay. They heard a million tiny metallic pings as gravity settled the ship. The laden must be docking to a spinning station or a rotating asteroid. The cargo bay was a huge room, stacked to its ceiling with barrels and crates. There were massive tanks of oil. Automated robot forklifts scurried between rows, checking for items that might have come loose in transit. There was a terrific clang as a docking clamp grabbed the ship.
"Cigars are this way," Kelly whispered.
She consulted her data pad, then tucked it back into her pocket. They moved out, clinging to the shadows. They stopped every few meters, listened, and made sure their fields of fire were clear. Kelly held up her hand and made a fist. She pointed to the secure hatch on the starboard side of the hold. John signaled Fred and Kelly and motioned them to go forward. Fred used the lockbreaker on the door, and it popped open. They entered and closed it behind them. John, Sam, and Linda waited. There was a sudden motion, and the Spartans snapped their weapons to firing positions. A robot forklift passed down an adjacent aisle. The massive aft doors of the cargo hold parted with a hiss. Light spilled into the hold. A dozen dock workers dressed in coveralls entered. John gripped his MA-2B tighter. One man looked down the aisle where they crouched in the shadows. He stooped, paused. John raised his weapon slowly, his hand steady, and sighted on the man's chest.
"Always shoot for center mass," Mendez had barked during weapons training.
The man stood, stretched his back, and moved on, whistling quietly to himself. Fred and Kelly returned, and Kelly opened and closed her hand, palm out. She had placed the marker. John grabbed his helmet from his duffel bag and slipped it on. He pinged the navigation marker and saw the blue triangle flash once on his heads-up display. He returned Kelly's thumbs up and removed the helmet. John stowed his helmet and ME-2B and motioned for the rest of his team to do the same. They casually walked out of the Leyden's aft cargo hold and onto the rebel base. The docking bay was hewn from solid rock. The ceiling stretched a kilometer high. Bright lights overhead effectively illuminated the place, looking like tiny suns in the sky. There were hundreds of ships docked within the cavern. Tiny single craft, Mako-class corvettes, cargo freighters, and even a captured UNSC Pelican dropship. Each craft was held by massive cranes that traveled on railroad tracks. The tracks led toward a series of large airlock doors. That's how the laden must have gotten inside. There were people everywhere, workers and men in crisp white uniforms. John's first instinct was to seek cover. Every one of them was a potential threat. He wished he had his gun in his hand. He remained calm and strode among these strangers. He had to set the right example for his team. If his recent encounter with the ODSTs in the gym of the Atlas had been any indication, he knew his team wouldn't interact well with the natives. John made his way past dock workers and robotic trams full of cargo and vendors selling roasted meat on sticks. He walked toward a set of double doors set in the far rock wall, marked Public Showers. He pushed through and didn't look back. The place was almost empty. One man was singing in the shower, and there were two rebel officers undressing near the towel dispensers. John led his team to the most distant corner of the locker room and hunkered down on one of the benches. Linda sat with her back to them, on lookout duty.
"So far, so good," John whispered. "This will be our fallback position if everything falls apart and we get separated."
Sam nodded. "Okay. We have a lead on how to find the colonel. Anyone have any ideas how to get off this rock once we grab him? Back into the Leyden's water tank?"
"Too slow," Kelly said. "We've got to assume that when Colonel Watt goes missing, his people are going to look for him."
"There was a pelican on the dock," John said. "We'll take it. Now let's figure out how to operate the cranes and airlocks."
Sam hefted his pack of explosives.
"I know just the way to politely knock on those airlock doors. Don't worry."
Sam tapped his left foot. He only did that when he was eager to move. Fred's hands were clenched into fists. He might be nervous, but he had it under control. Kelly yawned, and Linda sat absolutely still. They were ready. John got his helmet, donned it, and checked the nav marker.
"Bearing 320, he said. "It's on the move."
He picked up his gear. "And so are we." They left the showers and strode through the dock, past massive drop doors and into a city. This part of the asteroid looked like a canyon carved into the rock. John could barely make out the ceiling far overhead. There were skyscrapers and apartment buildings, factories, and even a small hospital. John ducked into an alley, slipped on his helmet, and pinpointed the blue nav marker. It overlay a cargo tram that silently rolled down the street. There were three armed guards riding in the back. The Spartans followed at a discreet distance. John checked his exit routes. Too many people, and too many unknowns. Were the people here armed? Would they all engage if fighting started? A few of the people gave him strange looks.
"Spread out," he whispered to his team. "We look like we're on a parade ground."
Kelly stepped up her pace and pulled ahead. Sam fell behind. Fred and Linda drifted to the right and left. The cargo tram turned and made its way slowly through a crowded street. It stopped at a building. The structure was 12 stories tall, with balconies on every floor. John guessed these were barracks. There were 2 armed guards in white uniforms at the front entrance. The 3 men in the tram got out and carried the crate inside. Kelly glanced at John. He nodded, giving her the go-ahead. She approached the 2 guards, smiling. John knew her smile wasn't friendly. She was smiling because she was finally getting a chance to put her training to the test. Kelly waved at the guard and pulled open the door. He asked her to stop and show her identification. She stepped inside, grabbed his rifle, twisted, and dragged him inside with her. The other guard stepped back and leveled his rifle. John sprang at him from behind, grabbed his neck and snapped it, then dragged his limp body inside. The entry room had cinder block walls and a steel door with a swipe card lock. A security camera dangled limply over Kelly's head. The guard she had dragged in lay at her feet. She was already running a cracking program on the lock, using her data pad. John retrieved his ME-2B and covered her. Fred and Linda entered and slipped out of their coveralls, then donned their helmets.
"Nav marker is moving," Linda reported. "Mark 270, elevation 10 meters, 20, 35 and holding. I'd say that's the top floor."
Sam entered, pulled the door shut behind him, and then jammed the lock.
"All clear out there."
The inner door clicked.
"Door's open," Kelly said.
John, Kelly, and Sam slipped out of their coveralls as Fred and Linda covered them. John activated the motion and thermal displays in his helmet. The target sight glowed as he raised his MA-2B.
"Go,"
John said. Kelly pushed open the door. Linda stepped in and to the right. John entered and took the left. Two guards were seated behind the lobby's reception desk. Another man, without a uniform, stood in front of the desk, waiting to be helped. Two more uniformed men stood by the elevator. Linda shot the three near the desk. John eliminated the targets by the elevator. Five rounds, five bodies hit the floor. Fred entered and policed the bodies, dragging them behind the counter. Kelly moved to the stairwell, opened the door, and gave the all-clear signal. The elevator pinged and its doors opened. They all wheeled, rifles leveled, but the car was empty. John exhaled, then motioned them to take the stairs. Kelly took point. Sam brought up the rear. They silently went up nine double flights of stairs. Kelly halted on an upper landing. She pointed to the interior of the building, then pointed up. John detected faint blurs of heat on the 12th floor. They'd have to pick a better route, a way in that no one would expect. John opened the door. There was an empty hallway. No targets. He went to the elevator doors and pried them open. Then he turned on his black suit's cooling elements to mask his thermal signature. The others did the same, and faded from his thermal imaging display. John and Sam climbed up the elevator cable. John glanced down. A 30-meter plunge into darkness. He might survive that fall. His bones wouldn't break, but there would be internal damage, and it would certainly compromise their mission. He tightened his grip on the cable and didn't look down again. When they had climbed up the last three floors, they braced themselves in the corners by the closed elevator door. Kelly and Fred snaked up the cable after them. They braced in the far corners to overlap their fields of fire. Linda came up last. She climbed as far as she could, hooked her foot on a cross brace, and hung upside down. John held up three fingers, two, then one, and then he and Sam silently pulled open the elevator doors. There were five guards standing in the room. They wore light body armor and helmets and carried older model HMG-38 rifles. Two of them turned. Kelly, Fred, and Linda opened fire. The walnut paneling behind the guards became pockmarked with bullet holes and was splattered with blood. The team slid inside the room, moving quickly and quietly. Sam policed the guards' weapons. There were two doors. One led to a balcony. The other featured a peephole. Kelly checked the balcony, then whispered over the channel in their helmets. "This overlooks the alley between the buildings. No activity." John checked the nav marker. The blue triangles flashed to position directly behind the other door. Sam and Fred flanked the door. John couldn't get a reading on motion or thermal. The walls were shielded. There were too many unknowns and not enough time. The situation wasn't ideal. They knew there were at least three men inside, the ones who had carried the crate upstairs, and there might be more guards, and to complicate the situation, their target had to be taken alive. John kicked the door in. He took in the entire situation at a glance. He was standing on the threshold of a sumptuous apartment. There was a wet bar boasting shelves of amber-filled bottles. A large round bed dominated the corner, decorated with shimmering silk sheets. Windows on all sides had sheer white curtains. John's helmet automatically compensated for the glare. Red carpet covered the floor. The crate with the cigars and champagne sat in the center of the room. It was black and armored, sealed tight against the vacuum of space. There were three men standing behind the armored crate, and one man crouched behind them. Colonel Robert Watts, their package. John didn't have a clear shot. If he missed, he could hit the colonel. The three men, however, didn't have that problem. They fired. John dove to his left. He caught three rounds in his side, knocking the breath from his body. One bullet penetrated his black suit. He felt it ping off his ribs, and pain slashed through him like a red-hot razor. He ignored the wound and rolled to his feet. He had a clear line of fire. He squeezed the trigger once. A three-round burst caught the center guard in the forehead. Sam and Fred wheeled around the doorframe, Sam high, Fred low. Their silenced weapons coughed, and the remaining pair of guards went down. Watts remained behind the crate. He brandished his pistol.
"Stop!" he screamed. "My men are coming! You think I'm alone? You're all dead! Drop your weapons!"
John crawled to the wet bar and crouched there. He willed the pain inside his stomach to go away. He signaled Sam and Fred and held up two fingers, then pointed the fingers over his head. Sam and Fred fired a burst of rounds over Watts. He ducked. John vaulted over the bar and leapt onto his quarry. He grabbed the pistol and wrenched it out of his hand, breaking the man's index finger and thumb. John snaked his arm around Watts's neck and choked the struggling man into near unconsciousness. Kelly and Linda entered. Kelly took out a syringe and injected Watts. Enough polypseudomorphine to keep him sedated for the better part of a day. Fred fell back to cover the elevator. Sam entered and crouched by the windows, watching the street below for any signs of trouble. Kelly went to John and peeled back his black suit. Her gloves were slick with his blood. "The bullet is still inside," she said, and bit her lower lip. "There's a lot of internal bleeding. Hang on." She dug a tiny bottle from her belt and inserted the nozzle into the bullet hole. "This might sting a little." The self-sealing biofoam filled John's abdominal cavity. It also stung like 100 ants crawling through his innards. She pulled the bottle out and taped up the hole. "You're good for a few hours," she said, and then gave him a hand up. John felt shaky, but he'd make it. The foam would keep him from bleeding to death and stave off the shock, for a while at least.
"Incoming vehicles," Sam announced. "Six men entering the building, two taking up position outside, but just the front."
"Get our package inside that crate and seal it up," John ordered.
He left the room, got his duffel, and went to the balcony. He secured a rope and tossed it down 12 stories into the alley. He rappelled down, took a second to scan the alley for threats, then clicked his throat mic once, the all-clear signal. Kelly snapped a descent rig on the crate and pushed it off the balcony. It zipped down the line and thudded to a halt at the bottom. A moment later, the rest of the team glided down the rope. They quickly donned their coveralls. Sam and Fred carried the crate as they entered the adjacent building. They exited on the street a half block down and walked as quickly as they could back to the docks. Dozens of uniformed men ran from the dock toward the city. No one challenged them. They re-entered the now deserted public showers.
"Everyone check your seals," John said. "Sam, you go ring the doorbell. Meet us on the dropship."
Sam nodded and sprinted out of the building, both packs of C-12 looped around his shoulder. John took out the panic button. He triggered the green mode transmission and tossed it into an empty locker. If they didn't make it out, at least the UNSC fleet would know where to find the rebel base.
"Your suit is breached," Kelly reminded John. "We'd better get to the ship now before Sam sets off his fireworks."
Linda and Fred checked the seals on the crate, then carried it out. Kelly took point, and John brought up the rear. They boarded the Pelican dropship, and John sized up her armaments. Dented and charred armor, a pair of old, out-of-date 40-millimeter chain guns. The rocket pods had been removed. Not much of a warhorse. There was a flash of lightning at the far end of the dock. The thunder roiled through the deck and then through John's stomach. While John watched, a gaping hole materialized in the airlock door amid a cloud of smoke and shattered metal. black space loomed beyond. With an ear-splitting roar, the atmosphere held in the docks abruptly transformed into a hurricane. People, crates, and debris were blasted out of the ragged tear. John pulled himself inside the dropship and prepared to seal the main hatch. He watched as emergency doors descended over the breached airlock. There was a second explosion, and the drop door paused, then fell and clattered to the deck, crushing a light transport vessel underneath. Behind them, large bay doors closed, sealing the docks off from the city. Dozens of workers still on the docks ran for their lives, but didn't make it. Sam sprinted across the deck, perfectly safe inside his sealed black suit. He cycled through the Pelican's emergency airlock.
"Back door's open," he said with a grin.
Kelly fired up the engines. The Pelican lifted, maneuvered through the dock, and then out through the blasted hole and into open space. She pushed the throttle to maximum burn. Behind them, the insurgent base looked like any other rock in the asteroid belt, but this rock was venting atmosphere and starting to rotate erratically. After 5 minutes at full power, Kelly eased the engines back.
"We'll hit the extraction point in 2 hours," she said.
"Check on our prisoner," John said. Sam popped open the crate.
"The seal's held. Watts is still alive and has a steady pulse," he said.
"Good," John grunted. He winced as the throbbing pain in his side increased.
"Something bothering you?" Kelly asked. "How's that biofoam holding up?"
"It's fine," he said without even looking at the hole in his side. "I'll make it." He knew he should feel elated, but instead he just felt tired. Something didn't sit right about the operation. He wondered about all the dead dock workers and civilians back there. None of them were designated targets, and yet weren't they all rebels on that asteroid? On the other hand, it was like the chief said. He had followed his orders, completed his mission, and gotten his people out alive. What more did he want? John stuffed his doubts deep in the back of his mind. "Nothing's wrong," he said, and squeezed Kelly's shoulder. John smiled. "What could be wrong? We won."
Chapter 11. 0600 hours, November 2nd, 2525, military calendar. Epsilon Eridani System. Reach UNSC Military Complex. Planet Reach. John wondered who had died. Before now, there had only been one reason for the Spartans to be called to muster in their dress uniforms. Funeral detail. The purple heart awarded to him after his last mission glistened on his chest. He made sure it was polished to a high sheen. It stood out against the black wool of his dress jacket. Occasionally, John would look at it and make sure it was still there. He sat in the third row of the amphitheater and faced the center platform. The other Spartans sat quietly on the concentric rings of risers. Spotlights flicked on the empty stage. He had been in Reach's secure briefing chamber before. This is where Dr. Halsey had told him they were going to be soldiers. This is where his life had changed, and he had been given a purpose. Chief Mendez entered the room and marched to the center platform. He, too, wore his black dress uniform as well. His chest was covered with silver and bronze stars, 3 Purple Hearts, the Red Legion of Honor Award, and a rainbow of campaign ribbons. He had recently shaved his head. The Spartans rose and stood at attention. Dr. Halsey entered. She looked older to John. The wrinkles at the corners of her eyes and mouth were pronounced, streaks of gray in her dark hair. But her blue eyes were as sharp as ever. She wore gray slacks, a black shirt, and her glasses hung about her neck on a gold chain.
"Admiral on deck," Mendez announced.
They all snapped straighter. A man 10 years Dr. Halsey senior strode to the stage. His short silver hair looked like a steel helmet. His gait had a strange lope to it, what crewmen called spacewalk, from spending too much time in microgravity. He wore a simple, unadorned black dress UNSC uniform, no medals or campaign ribbons. The insignia on the forearm of his jacket, however, was unmistakable, the single gold star of a rear admiral.
"At ease, Spartans," he said. "I'm Admiral Stanforth."
The Spartans took their seats in unison. Dust swirled on stage and collected into a robed figure. Its face was obscured within the shadows of its hood. John could discern no hands at the end of his sleeves.
"And this is Beowulf,"
Admiral Stanforth said, as he gestured to the ghostly creature. Stanforth's voice was calm, but distaste was evident on his face.
"He is our AI attaché with the Office of Naval Intelligence."
He turned away from the AI.
"We have several important issues to cover this morning, so let's get started."
The lights dimmed. An amber sun appeared in the center of the room, with three planets in close orbit.
"This is Harvest," he said. "Population of approximately 3 million. Although on the periphery of UNSC-controlled space, this world is one of our more productive and peaceful colonies."
The holographic view zoomed in on the surface of the world and showed grasslands and forests and 1,000 lakes swarming with the schools of fish.
"As of military calendar February 3, at 1423 hours, the Harvest orbital platform made long-range radar contact with this object."
A blurry outline appeared over the stage.
"Spectroscopic analysis proved inconclusive,"
Admiral Stanforth said.
"The object is constructed of material unknown to us."
A molecular absorption graph appeared on the side screen, spikes and jagged lines indicating the relative proportions of elements. Beowulf raised a cloaked arm, and the image darkened. The words "classified, eyes only" appeared over the blackened data. Admiral Stanforth shot a glare at the AI.
"Contact with Harvest," he continued, "was lost shortly thereafter. The Colonial Military Administration sent the scout ship Argo to investigate. That ship arrived in system on April 20th, but other than a brief transmission to confirm their exit slipstream position, no further reports were made. In response, Fleet Command assembled a battle group to investigate. The group consisted of the destroyer Heracles, commanded by Captain Verardi, as well as the frigates Arabia and Vostok. They entered the Harvest system on October 7th and discovered the following."
The holograph of the planet Harvest changed. The lush fields and rolling hills transformed, morphing into a cratered, barren desert. Thin gray sunlight reflected off a glassy crust. Heat wavered from the surface. Isolated regions glowed red.
"This is what was left of the colony."
The admiral paused for a moment to stare at the image, and then continued.
"We assume that all inhabitants are lost."
3 million lives lost. John couldn't fathom the raw force it had taken to kill so many. For a moment he was torn between horror and envy. He glanced at the purple heart pinned to his chest and remembered his lost comrades. How did one simple bullet wound compare with so many wasted lives? He was suddenly no longer proud of the decoration.
"And this is what the Heracles battle group found in orbit,"
Admiral Stanforth told them. The blurry outline that was still visible, hanging in the air, sharpened into crisp focus. It looked smooth and organic, and the hull possessed an odd, opalescent sheen. It looked more like the carapace of an exotic insect than the metal hull of a spacecraft. Recessed into the aft section were pods that pulsed with a purple-white glow. The prow of the craft was swollen like the head of a whale. John thought it possessed an odd, predatory beauty.
"The unidentified vessel," the admiral said, "launched an immediate attack against our forces."
Blue flashes strobed from the ship. Red motes of light then appeared along its hull. Bolts of energy coalesced into a fiery smear against the blackness of space. The deadly flashes of light impacted on the Arabia, splashed across its hull. Its meter of armor plating instantly boiled away, and a plume of ignited atmosphere burst from the breach in the ship's hull.
"Those were pulse lasers," Admiral Stanforth explained. "And, if this record is to be believed,
some kind of self-guided, superheated plasma weapon.
The Heracles and Vostok launched salvos of missiles toward the craft. The enemy's lasers shot half before they reached their target. The balance of the missiles impacted, detonated into blossoms of fire that quickly faded. The strange ship shimmered with a semi-transparent silver coating, which then vanished.
"They also seem to have some reflective energy shield."
Admiral Stanforth took a deep breath, and his features hardened into a mask of grim resolve.
"The Vostok and Arabia were lost with all hands. The Heracles jumped out of the system, but due to the damage she sustained, it took several weeks for Captain Verardi to make it back to reach. These weapons and defensive systems are currently beyond our technology. Therefore, this craft is of non-human origin."
He paused, then added,
"The product of race with technology far in advance of our own."
A murmur buzzed through the chamber.
"We have, of course, developed a number of first contact scenarios,"
the Admiral continued,
"and Captain Verardi followed our established protocols. We had hoped that contact with a new race would be peaceful. Obviously, this was not the case. The alien vessel did not open fire until our task force attempted to initiate communications."
He paused, considering his words.
"Fragments of the enemy's transmissions were intercepted," he continued. "A few words have been translated. We believe they call themselves the Covenant. However, before opening fire, the alien ship broadcast the following message in the clear."
He gestured at Beowulf, who nodded. A moment later, a voice thundered from the amphitheater speakers. John stiffened in his seat when he heard it. The voice from the speakers sounded odd, artificial, strangely calm and formal, but laden with rage and menace.
"Your destruction is the will of the gods, and we are their instrument."
John was awestruck. He stood.
"Yes, Spartan?" Stanforth said.
"Sir, is this a translation?"
"No,"
the Admiral replied.
"They broadcast this to us in our language. We believe they used some kind of translation system to prepare the message, but it means they've been studying us for some time."
John took his seat.
"As of November 1, the UNSC has been ordered to full alert," Stanforth said. "Vice Admiral Preston Cole is mobilizing the largest fleet action in human history to retake the Harvest system and confront this new threat. Their transmission made one thing perfectly clear. They're looking for a fight."
Only years of military discipline kept John rooted to his seat. Otherwise, he would have stood up and asked to volunteer on the spot. He would have given anything to go and fight. This was the threat he and the other Spartans had been training for all their lives. He was certain of it. Not scattered rebels, pirates, or political dissidents.
"Because of this UNSC-wide mobilization," Admiral Stanforth continued, "your training schedule will be accelerated to its final phase. Project Mjolnir."
He stepped away from the podium and clasped his hands behind his back.
"To that end, I'm afraid I have another unpleasant announcement."
He turned to the chief.
"Chief Petty Officer Mendez will be departing us to train the next group of Spartans. Chief?"
John grabbed the edge of the riser. Chief Mendez had always been there for them, the only constant in the universe. Admiral Stanforth might as well have told him that Epsilon Eridani was leaving the Reach system. The chief stepped to the podium and clasped its edges.
"Recruits," he said. "Soon your training will be complete, and you will graduate to the rank of Petty Officer Second Class in the UNSC. One of the first things you will learn is that change is part of a soldier's life. You will make and lose friends. You will move. This is part of the job."
He looked to his audience. His dark eyes rested on each one of them. He nodded, seemingly satisfied with what he saw.
"The Spartans are the finest group of soldiers I have ever encountered," he said. "It has been a privilege to train you. Never forget what I've tried to teach you: duty, honor, and sacrifice for the greater good of humanity are the qualities that make you the best.
He was silent for a moment, searching for more words. But finding none, he stood at attention and saluted.
Attention!
John barked. The Spartans rose as one and saluted the chief.
Dismissed, Spartans, Chief Mendez said. And good luck.
He finished his salute. The Spartans snapped down their arms. They hesitated, and then reluctantly filed out of the amphitheater. John stayed behind. He had to talk to Chief Mendez. Dr. Halsey spoke briefly with the chief and the admiral, then she and the admiral left together. Beowulf backed toward the far wall and faded away like a ghost. The chief gathered his hat, spotted John, and walked to him. He nodded to the hologram of the scorched colony, Harvest, still rotating in the air.
"One final lesson, Petty Officer," he said. "What tactical options do you have when attacking a stronger opponent?"
"Sir," John said, "there are two options. Attack swiftly and with full force at their weakest point. Take them out quickly before they have a chance to respond."
"Good," he said. "And the other option?"
"Fall back," John replied. "Engage in guerrilla actions or get reinforcements."
The chief sighed.
"Those are the correct answers," he said. "But it may not be enough to be correct this time. Sit, please."
John sat, and the chief settled next to him on the riser.
"There's a third option."
The chief turned his hat over in his hands.
"An option that others may eventually consider."
"Sir?"
"Surrender," the chief whispered. "That, however, is never an option for the likes of you and me. We don't have the luxury of backing down."
He glanced up at Harvest, a glittering ball of glass.
"And I doubt that an enemy like this will let us surrender."
"I think I understand, sir."
"Make sure you do. And make sure you don't let anyone else give up."
He gazed into the shadows beyond the center platform.
"Project Mjolnir will make the Spartans into something new. Something I could never forge them into. I can't fully explain. That damned O&I spook is still here listening. Just trust Dr. Halsey."
The chief dug into his jacket pocket.
"I was hoping to see you before they shipped me out. I have something for you."
He set a small metal disc on the riser between them.
"When you first came here," the chief said, "you fought the trainers when they took this away from you. Broke a few fingers, as I recall."
His chiseled features cracked into a rare smile. John picked up the disc and examined it. It was an ancient silver coin. He flipped it between his fingers.
"It has an eagle on one side," Mendez said. "That bird is like you, fast and deadly."
John closed his fingers around the quarter. "Thank you, sir." He wanted to say that he was strong and fast because the chief had made him so. He wanted to tell him that he was ready to defend humanity against this new threat. He wanted to say that without the chief, he would have no purpose, no integrity, and no duty to perform. But John didn't have the words. He just sat there. Mendez stood.
"It has been an honor to serve with you."
Instead of saluting, he held out his hand. John got to his feet. He took the chief's hand and they shook. It took a great deal of effort. Every instinct screamed at him to salute.
"Goodbye," Chief Mendez said.
He turned briskly on his heel and strode from the room. John never saw him again. Chapter 12. 1750 hours, November 27, 2525, military calendar. UNSC frigate Commonwealth, en route to the UNSC Damascus Materials Testing Facility, Planet Kai CD4. The viewscreen of the bunk room of the UNSC frigate Commonwealth clicked on as the ship entered normal space. Ice particles showered the external camera and gave the distant yellow sun, Kai Seti, a ghostly ring. John watched and continued to ponder the word Mjolnir as they sped in system. He had looked it up in the education database.
Mjolnir was the hammer used by the Norse god of thunder. Project Mjolnir had to be some kind of weapon. At least he hoped it was. They needed something to fight the Covenant. If it was a weapon, though, why was it here at the Damascus testing facility, on the very edge of UNSC-controlled space? He had only even heard of this system 24 hours ago. He turned and surveyed the squad. Although this bunkroom had 100 beds, the Spartans still clustered together, playing cards, polishing boots, reading, exercising. Sam sparred with Kelly, although she had to slow herself down considerably to give him a chance. John was reminded that he didn't like being on starships. The lack of control was disturbing. If he wasn't stuck in the freezer, the starship's cramped, unpleasant cryo chamber, he was left waiting and wondering what their next mission would be. During the last 3 weeks, the Spartans had handled a variety of minor missions for Dr. Halsey. Tying up loose ends, she had called it. Putting down rebel factions on Jericho 7, removing a black market bazaar near the Roosevelt military base. Each mission had brought them closer to the Chi Seti system. John had made sure every member of his squad had participated in these missions. They had performed flawlessly. There had been no losses. Chief Mendez would have been proud of them.